Item number one for the work session is related to excessive use of city services for congregate care facilities. Is that you, Chief Conley?
Yes. Chair Erickson.
Hello, no.
Good evening, Chair Erickson, members of the council, Sean Conley, Fire Chief. Here tonight to give a presentation and look for some discussion and some guidance on excessive use of public safety resources. This is a collaborative effort with police department and the fire department. As we've been spending a lot of time with all congregate care facilities and the services that we're providing and trends that we are concerned about. So to help kind of set the tone for this evening, I know we've had a lot of discussion in the background. Really, this is a continuation of that conversation and moving more towards a discussion on gaining some guidance for some fee structures and better understanding of how we want to move forward as a city. So this evening, we're going to talk a little bit about the community impact, some of the statistics, some brief introductions on the necessity of this evening's conversation, our impact to public safety and the services that are being provided and the services also that are being impacted or not able to meet. And then we're going to give some examples of the proposed fee structure and then talk about next steps. So currently, you have seen two separate numbers. So there are over 400 congregate care facilities currently in Brooklyn Park. We have also seen over 500 facilities, and those 500 consist of offices, not necessarily healthcare facilities. But currently, there's about 424 congregate care facilities that police and fire respond to on a regular basis. This number is increasing, and we're going to talk a little bit about that here in upcoming slides. And really, the basis for this conversation is this is business generated, and it is a disproportionate demand on police and fire as we respond to not just medicals, but calls for service. And those medicals can be anywhere from traumatic injuries to medical injuries to mental health injuries, and as we're going to demonstrate, a lot of these are low acuity type responses due to augment staff providing care for residents. This is a brief call volume for 2025. This is all encompassing for police and fire. As you can see, there was about 1,400 calls for service citywide. Out of our 9,996, 1,439 was associated to congregate care facilities. And that is 15% of our calls. To put it in perspective, of our four stations, each of those companies run between 8 and 13 calls per company. And 33% of the time, we're on two or more calls simultaneously. We do have time requirements. We're trying to get to medicals from the time of notification until the time we're by somebody's side within that roughly 7-minute area. For fires, we're trying to get between 5 minutes and 20 seconds to 7 minutes. And the reason why I highlight that is because there is an impact if we are on low acuity calls, meaning they're non-emergent in nature, we will have a delay in response to more emergent type of a call, whether it be a fire, a traumatic injury, a serious medical call. And police are right alongside us. We're going to these same types of calls. and they have a little bit more of a robust system when we're talking about community paramedicine and critical interventionalists. The intent not is to get into the specifics of these call the nature of these calls, but just to highlight the percentage that police and fire are both responding to low acuity congregate care facilities. This is an overview of the region. I understand that this is somewhat hard to see, but It does break down a managed facility density, given the city's authority to limit the number of concentration of facilities, prevent oversaturation, and to ensure a fair regional distribution. We are not a city of the first class, so we do not have distance requirements. So the increase of congregate cab facilities that are coming into the city of Brooklyn Park are disproportionate to the surrounding cities and counties as well. You can see this snapshot is taken from City View. We are doing the best job that we can to track these congregate care facilities when they come into the city. There is, without getting into the specifics of how MDH goes through permitting, we do not have the ability to see a lot of the permitting or the life safety or to enforce life safety components. But as you can see, the assisted living facilities and provisional assisted living facilities continue to increase. There is a list of type of facilities that provide care, and this number from 424 identified congregate care living homes or facilities continues to grow. The nature of the slide is more specific to police calls for service. That coincides with what you're seeing. This bar graph just does show a gradual uptick, but well, from 21 to 2025, you can see in that 4-5 year period, the calls have almost doubled. And I'll pause now if Deputy Faust has anything that he would like to add to this slide for conversation. Okay. So highlighting some of our concerns for the facilities, we are very concerned about our residents' care. And some of these types of responses are to augment staff, either lack of training, lack of use or ability to use devices such as Hoyer lifts or lift assists. And this is more a concern on the private enterprise side of the congregate care or group home facilities. So when we're able to reduce some of these calls for low acuity responses, that allows for Brooklyn Park Police, Brooklyn Park Fire to be able to respond more efficiently and effectively to more critical nature calls. This does absolutely, just as I said earlier, does create a delay in higher priority calls from low acuity to high acuity. Once we arrive at the address or the scene of somebody who's called 911, even for a low acuity call, we're not able to leave them, in a sense, triage and go to a higher priority call until that issue is resolved. That would, in a sense, result in abandonment. So we need to finish the care that's being provided to that low acuity call to allow us to respond to a more high acuity call. And while we do have mutual aid auto aid agreements in place, there are delays in response times to those types of calls. So why may a fee schedule be necessary? Our public resources are being excessively utilized beyond their intended purposes for any facility who needs 911 support. These private facilities do ship operational costs to public safety. It doesn't matter if it's response during the day back and forth, where the care that's being provided to those residents should be from us. From a certified nursing assistants to what they call a lower level nursing skills. We often are responding to these group homes and providing training and education to staff, whether or not wise did not receive it from their employer, and such as helping people transition from bed to chair or from chair to bed. We do want to promote accountability and operational changes at the facility level. We do create a proactive relationship to help augment the needs of the staff. That is what we've been doing for a while, and it's important for us to highlight that because we're not saying that these types of calls don't matter. What we are saying is that the business and the facility needs to take the ownership to train the staff appropriately and to provide the best care available. This does not in any way affect somebody calling 911 because they have an emergency or a need. We absolutely have been and will continue to provide the highest level of service possible. We do want to protect the taxpayers from subsidizing the private care facilities and for all the examples that I previously mentioned, and also to be able to respond to the immediate needs. And in 2025, that stands for itself, the type of calls that we've been responding to and the critical nature of the services that we provide. This is for our consideration, just to provide a little bit of guidance. We could do an independent fee for the police department and the fire department. We could discuss one public safety fee, such as if there was a range between $500 and $800 per incident. That is one of the ways that we start to help assign that responsibility to where it is, as well as considering fee escalation. Now, with those three options, I want to go back to the considerations for keep in mind when we talk about the nature of fees for the fire department or the police department. This gets very specific, and we continue to discuss these options because of the nature of the services that we provide. The fire department has a standalone fee schedule, no difference for false alarms or reoccurring alarms. It doesn't matter if it's malicious or not. Sometimes it's often facilities needing to upgrade their fire protection systems, but when we're running two or three or four times back to back to that same facility, that is another consideration, and that is an example of what we want to do is try to fix the problem, not just continue to respond in the same manner. This is an example of what the current fee schedule supports and the starting point for fee escalation. This in no way is to say this is the only way to do it. There are a number of states throughout the United States that have these types of fees for congregate care response or low acuity response, as well as fee escalations. So in summary, police department and the fire department are concerned about the increased demands on low acuity calls. We are respectfully requesting guidance on adopting a congregate care excessive use fee schedule while considering options to establish an ordinance authority and discuss a billing process. And lastly, to ensure that the Brooklyn Park Emergency Services are able to meet the critical needs of the community. And with that, I can stand for any questions.
Thank you, Chair Harrison. So thank you, Chief, for this presentation. Excuse me. Do we have any, as a city, are there any inspections that fall on us prior to these facilities opening after their license, or how the process works chronologically from the state? State licenses these facilities, correct?
Correct. Yeah, Chair Erickson, Councilmember Garvey. We do not have any authority to provide any life safety inspections. If we respond to a group home and we see something that's immediately dangerous to life and health, we will address it on the spot. We then have the option to go fill out a MARC report that goes to the Minnesota Department of Health and for them to follow up. We work collaboratively with the police department to try to correct the nature of that call, but in a sense, we do not have the authority to do a pre-site inspection before the business is up and running.
And do we know, does the state do a facilities inspection or a staff inspection? Those seem to be the two things here that we're working to try and mitigate, is an untrained staff and get into a facility. I would assume there had to be some kind of inspection to run a business out of a facility, especially when people's lives are on the line.
Chair Erickson, members of the council, Councilmember Garvey, I'm trying to learn more about the state's inspection process. What I've learned from even our community partners is the consistency, and I want to be careful with that because we just don't understand it. And what I mean by that is some of the things that when we respond to group homes, they're not consistent. Whereas if we did a building inspection or in the city of Brooklyn Park did a building inspection for life safety, or we had could partner with the state or the city to go to a life safety inspection and a building inspection, that would be the best opportunity for us to ensure at that time that the business was set up for success. It doesn't mean that they wouldn't change it in the future, but in a sense, and this is something we've seen on a number of occasions, is when we have very large patients that are in a basement with no egress window or no opportunity to get out. And I mean patients in weights of excess of 500 pounds. That is a significant undertaking for all of our crews, police and fire and EMS, working collaboratively to get together. That would be something that we would be able to proactively say, a basement bedroom would not be good for this patient because they're non-ambulatory and cannot self-rescue. And the nature of which we would have to bring resources in to provide that type of rescue if that facility was on fire would bring a significant delay.
Yeah. Thank you. And then just a technical question on these charts that have the types, license types. Is there a place that I could go online or wherever, state's website, that would kind of delineate what each of these license types means?
Yes, and let me, Chair, to members of the council, Councilmember McGarvey, let me put together some information with you or for you, so we can maybe provide some better oversight on those license types and those call differentiations.
Thank you, and I have the same or similar question to the next page of the police calls for service at congregate living facilities. We'll just be looking for a key. I mean, some of those are self-explanatory, some are not.
Yes.
I would like to know what they are at some point. And if there's a place I can go and look at, I'll look at them. But if you guys can provide that or need to, I appreciate that.
Absolutely, Chair, to members of the council. Councilmember McGarvey, over directly with Detective Brown to be able to provide a little bit more clarity on those call types. And we can start to break down what that information looks like. And this is a good opportunity for me to share that this is labor intensive. The current system set up in the state is not user friendly. Talking with Detective Brown earlier today, she's put a significant amount of time in just trying to understand a lot of the data. And it's a challenge because it's not clear. And she does this on a regular basis. I can sense the frustration in her voice today. I'm just trying to find clarity of its capacity. And then it's the services that we're providing, both as a community, but then also as the congregate care facility. And it's frustrating when you see that they're not receiving the services for a quality of life type of conversation. On top of when there are infractions and MARC reports are filled out, there's a delay in which the state agencies respond to that. If you go to the state website, in 2025, there was over 50,000 MARC reports filed. That means somebody is questioning the care that somebody is receiving, and they are requesting an investigation into the care. That's a lot, over 50,000 concerned people. Yeah. So I will get with Detective Brown, and we will put some information together for you.
Thank you, Chair.
Yes, sir.
Okay, Councilmember Tran. Councilmember Tran. Can I?
Councilmember Tran.
Oh, yes. Now I can hear you. Not just the question, but I suggest that I agree with you about the data that are a lot out there in the state, and not sure which one, you know, for this kind of facility. But I do know that in some case like congregate or you know, housing, if they register to take care of the public by the state fund and they don't do good their job, they can the person live in those facility, they can report to the DHS or the board nursing. So if you can study more about that and post the information for how the people that, you know, write the complaint to that you know, facility, you know, so that they don't make a wrong call, like just keep calling the 911 or you know, like abuse of the system, that would be, you know, appreciated.
Okay, Councilmember Zhang and then Councilmember Page.
Chair and members of council, Councilmember Tran, thank you. I will look into highlighting the complaint process. How that's going, and specifically look more into nursing complaints as well.
Thank you.
First and foremost, thank you for all that you want to, because you're super duper cool. A few questions about the facilities. Are the calls typically made by the facilities themselves, or is it by the tenants?
Chair and members of the council, Councilmember John, they are made by the facilities themselves, the staff.
Thank you. And so with you mentioning earlier, a lot of the health impacts is based upon the facilities, basically like negligence, right? And so just for a point of clarity, who would be responsible in paying that excessive fee? Would it be going, like, billed towards the facilities directly?
Correct, council. Chair Erickson, Councilmember Zhang, it would be on the business side of that. We have discussed what that looks like, because it can't just be by address. We need to know what, for example, group home is managed by that business, and that fee would go directly to that business that it's licensed under.
Thank you. And I don't want to, like, put us in, like, what if situations, but are we looking to take any sort of precautions if then these facilities refuse to call for help and to not get billed? You know what I mean?
Chair Erickson, members of the council, Councilmember Zhang, that is a great point. We're not, a lot of this education that happens on a day-to-day basis, I appreciate you using the term neglect, because we see that. We're not trying to deter anybody who's confused on what's happening from calling 911. That, in a sense, gets triaged. Every time somebody calls 911, a lot of the times they'll say chest pain. We get there, and it's a traumatic injury. They may have chest pain as a result of falling, you know, off a deck or out of a tree, and they didn't tell the dispatcher that they fell out of a tree, and now they have a traumatic injury, and that's why they have the chest pain. So we are going there and troubleshooting. When we have an opportunity to provide some education, we do that. But a lot of times we're seeing neglect. And that's our concern. And that's why we're trying to target that. And proactively, in discussions today, there's some opportunities to provide some letters to some of these businesses, say, this is what we're seeing. We want to encourage you to keep up with your training or provide a better service. On this date and time, we had a concern or an interaction with your team here. But this is a repetitious type of an event when we're being called on a regular basis to come put or come transfer a patient from the bed to a chair because you don't have enough help or you don't have the right equipment or you don't have the right training. That is the type of focus that we want to reduce those calls types and to ensure that there isn't any confusion. If you have an emergency, call 911. We're going to come support you. But if you're using this because it's something that you don't have the right resources or the right training, that's not an emergency, and that's not an appropriate use of emergency services.
Sure. Thank you. Any questions? Thank you, Chair Erickson. Thank you for the presentation. For discussion purposes, I just want to share my thoughts that it's very clear that we have way too many facilities. And at the rapid and record pace in our city, there's no doubt we're behind for inspections and the entities that are required to, they simply can't do that. But at the same time, there is a need, so they will continue to take our housing stock, they will continue to use our resources, and there's nothing we can do about it at this moment. So for discussion purposes, I would be more in favor of a sizable and flat fee to do business in our city for every single congregate care facility, or however we define that list. I know there's multiple, I'd like to know what the five unknowns are. I don't know what those are, but that list, however we define that, and I know that takes a little bit more consideration. But I really do believe if we have the same neglectful owners or caregivers or just simply unskilled folks taking care of these people, I think that they will not call. And I think if they knew that it was going to be a call each time, I see that as a really, really bad outcome. So I would be more inclined. I think it does a couple of things. I think it says, okay, this is what you need to pay to do business, and they are paid well. These caregivers are paid well for each of those folks. And that's a part of them doing business. So I think that would say reputable businesses who have the funds understand that this is what you need to do in our city, and then also ease that burden for the high percentage of calls that our emergency services are doing. But then also, it's 0 to 1 million calls based on that one fee. I feel more comfortable with that as an option versus a per call fee. And that is just commentary. I don't have a question in there, but that's how I'm feeling in the discussion.
Chair Erickson, members of the council, also on the page. I just wanted to weigh in on that point because I think it's an important point. When we think about doing things like this, obviously the last thing we want to do would be to deter somebody from calling 911. I mean, that's not the intention here, and nor would we ever want it to be a secondary impact because of a program we put in place. I do think that from the police department perspective, we recognize that these repeat calls, and that's really what I think this is about, is the repeat calls, and especially calls that the facility should be able to handle on their own without our assistance. that's really what we're looking to deter, I think, from our perspective. And I also want to acknowledge that we do have slightly different, you know, perspectives from fire and police because the type of calls that we deal with are different. Some of the calls that we deal with and some of the repeat facility calls are complex. You know, maybe it is the resident calling, maybe it's the group home staff calling, maybe one calls one day, one calls another day, and it does consume a lot of resources. Officer time, alternative response time. And some of the calls just, there's a better way to handle it. The facility should be able to handle it. So I do want to point out, like, when considering this, there's some nuances to it. And one comparison I would just make, just to keep in mind, is we utilize a crime-free housing addendum ordinance in this city. The police department uses that, but we use it very specifically and with precision. When we have a rental unit that is call after call after call, repeat calls, we start talking about the appropriateness of using the crime-free housing addendum. It's something different, but I think the approach here could be worth considering rather than a program that every call that we go on, we assess it for whether or not it's going to meet an excessive use and then issue a violation. This could be a tool that we use on a precision basis when we know that there is a facility that is chronically understaffed or chronically undertrained or continuing to show time and time again that they can't care for the residents. We feel like there's nothing that we can do. This could be something that at that point in time we might be able to utilize as a tool rather than using it as a blanket policy. So that's just an alternative that I would throw out there that we have internally discussed. And again, I will reiterate what the fire chief is. We're looking for direction from you guys on what how you'd like us to proceed with this. So those are just some of the things that we've talked about. I think there's different approaches to how we could use this. It doesn't mean that every single call would necessarily need to be assessed and then a fee issued. There could be different uses, and we have those different models in other areas. So, thank you.
Thank you, Jeff Erickson. Thank you for that. I certainly want them to pay. That's what I want. So, but let me ask you about that. What's the criteria for that for the repeat offenders, for the, how does that ordinance read for me, just for my understanding?
Chair Erickson, members of the council, Councilmember Page, if you're referring to the crime-free housing addendum ordinance, there's two ordinances that we can lean into. One of them has stipulations where there are several warnings issued, and on the fourth instance of an evident issue, then that's when we invoke the authority, and code enforcement ultimately is the mechanism for enforcing against the landlord in those cases. And crime-free also has a more severe section where if there's a severe crime that's not just a small nuisance crime, then we could issue a crime-free letter to the landlord and invoke on something serious like assault or serious assault is where we typically see it. So it has multiple different approaches, and I think that the city attorney has also drafted up some language that we've looked over as well that has some different options there. So I think the topic is pretty complex, actually. So it's there's a lot of different avenues we can go down with this.
I have a few questions here. One is kind of a point of curiosity. So there's private businesses that are operating congregate care facilities, and then there's kind of larger statewide, not Lutheran Social Services, Catholic Charities, so on and so forth. Do you notice any difference in the quality of care in kind of those two buckets of operators?
Yeah, Chair Erickson, members of the council. There are. To be transparent, it's one of those things that this is going to require some more of the deep dive, because one of the ways to qualify or to qualify your question would be how many of these facilities and what facilities have marked reports against them, and then in what period of time, not just how many in a year, but then how close, per month, per 60, 90 days, was there staff turnover, what were those types of dynamics. I feel like we're scraping the surface of this, because we can chase this down a rabbit hole, because it's so data driven and it's difficult to find. Our staff, when they recognize that something that is neglect or concern, we report it with police, complete a MARC report. In some cases, some we'll call it county social services. It's difficult, but yes, there are some addresses that are worse than ours.
My next question relates to the last time I did a ride along with fire. We went to a home, group home, a congregate care facility. There was a person who had called 911 complaining of a severe headache, maybe related to a head injury. So we get there, and your team is trying to talk to the staff at the group home, and this person was unable to answer very basic questions, like, is this person diabetic? Does this person have a history of traumatic brain injury? Like, very basic questions that I would expect someone who's caring for my loved one to know the answer to. And not where they would have to go dive deep in a book to find it, but if you're responsible for this person, these are pretty basic things that a staff member should know. Curious about, rather than excessive use, maybe fining the negligence, or can an operator be held criminally liable for negligence? At least in my mind, that amounts to negligence of a criminal nature, from what I saw happen that night. So, curious if you could weigh in on that balance.
Chair Erickson, members of the council, I don't have the statute in front of me. I don't think that would amount to negligence. I think there would need to be more of an overt act. Just the fact of not knowing some information, and truthfully, what we see a lot of times is they do rely on the literature, the documentation. Right or wrong, a lot of times that's what you see. You come and you start asking questions, things that the ambulance needs to go, it's straight to the book. They don't have it memorized. I don't think that not having it memorized, although I agree 100% with you, if that was my family member, I'd want them to know, be able to answer those basic questions. Not sure that that gets us into the criminal arena. Certainly, we can defer to city attorney to talk about whether that might meet the definition of inappropriate use. I see the medicals is difficult, because we're not expecting these folks to be doctors. Most of them have basic first aid. They don't have a high level of training, and I don't know that there is a standard of training for medical care, for congregate care. I think it depends on what level of facility we're talking about. There might be some requirements there. But we don't see typically a high level of medical care. So I think that all those things factor in. Now, if we were dealing with a facility that had was deemed as a the level of care, the expectation of level of care was much higher than, and we saw incompetence, and that might change things. So I'll pause there, and if City Attorney Thompson has any commentary.
I'll try this one more time.
Did you say one more time?
Maybe this will work better, though. Okay. Working a little bit. Can I put a pause on that question just for a second? Because I think it's important. You know, we've been working with staff on this for months. Okay? And what we've done is we've focused on two different types of ordinance. One is an inappropriate use of particularly fire services. The lift assist is the prime example of that, where they're calling, making calls for things that they should be doing themselves, and they're asking the fire department to do it. Okay. Those non-emergencies, if you have a congregate care facility that has a true emergency every day, that's not what we're trying to get at. We're trying to get at using particularly fire department services inappropriately, and particularly in the congregate care. With respect to the excessive use, that's a separate thing we've been dealing with, and that deals with people just making nuisance calls over and over and over. Not life-threatening, not necessarily congregate care facilities. It could be to an apartment complex. It could be to a home. It could be to a business. That's a separate category of concerns we're trying to address. So I think when the economy says, look, we understand we get called for emergencies, that's our job. That's not what we're trying to get at here.
Right.
Okay. Yep. With respect to the criminal, but let's assume you get a call, whether it's a business system right there, they discover something that's inappropriate. It would have to be pretty high level to be criminal, but that doesn't mean it's not reportable. Because keep in mind, cities don't license these facilities, or state license these facilities. So that's really how I think you get at it. But I don't want you to merge the inappropriate use of health or fire and safety versus inappropriate, meaning they shouldn't be calling you this many things this many times. So that's why we're trying to bisect these up.
So inappropriate may be a second conversation later on. Is that what I'm hearing? Excessive tonight, inappropriate later?
I think we've actually been discussing both. The staff's been discussing it in concept. Calling for a liquor service is an inappropriate use, not an excessive use. No, some people, some facilities might do it excessively, but that's not what you're trying to get at. You're trying to get at using fire services inappropriately, or police services inappropriately.
Mm-hmm.
So they're kind of two sides of the same coin, but a little bit different.
Okay.
This last question is related to so I've noticed two different scenarios. One, a resident of a congregate care living situation who's engaging in dangerous behaviors themselves at the home and being allowed to go out unsupervised. Is that something that you had called on regularly, where the level of care they're receiving is maybe not appropriate for their personal capabilities?
Chair Erickson, members of the council, that is a common call that we receive. It's typically initiated by the facility staff members who will call and say, so-and-so is not following the rules, so-and-so has left the house, we want to report them missing. So-and-so is not eating their food, or they're eating too much food, or they won't be quiet, it's after hours. But we do receive a lot of those calls. And that most of those, missing person is certainly a police matter most of the time, but a lot of these folks are not court ordered to be at the residence. They are free to leave. They're free adults. They can come and go as they please, and we have to take them as a missing person every time. So we report them missing, we take them missing, we do all the reporting that we need to do. And I don't think those are the cases that we're talking about here, but on a call, staff members calling and saying, resident A, B, or C does not want to go to their room, I'm asking them to go to their room. Well, that's not really, there's no assault, there's no crime, there's no argument. The staff is just not able to maintain control of the residents. And they're asking the police to come in and use their authority to essentially do their job. And that I think, starts falling into the excessive use, when that is what they're relying upon day in and day out, is let me just call the police and ask them to come over there because I can't do my job. Or the group home is understaffed, there's not enough staff to attend to the specific needs, and so I'm just gonna ask somebody in a uniform to come over and do that for me. I think that's kind of more what we're talking about, the excessive usage, where this is something that the group homes should be able to do, and that would be a reasonable expectation for them to do, but they're just choosing not to because it's just easier, rather than them have to go through the trouble of working with the resident. They're just gonna ask us to do it. And we run into that all the time, and I think that's where this conversation becomes very appropriate. And each case is different. Each case is nuanced, and I think that's the trouble in this is that it takes maybe some investigation at times. Maybe it's the officer having to look at the file of the individual and actually see what the expectations are of the group home. Those are typically listed out, like the group or the facility staff are expected to render these services, and then we have to make a determination that that's not happening. And so I think that each case, it really is a case-by-case basis, and some are maybe going to qualify based upon the definition that we find in the ordinance, and some won't. I guess I need to point out that I think that it could be meaningful work. It's going to be laborious work for the police department. I think we just need to call that what it is. And quite honestly, I think that we're a little concerned about our capacity to be able to do that, depending on the scale in which the council is envisioning this being applied. And I think that's part of the conversation, maybe not for today, but eventually down the road. I think we'd like to know what direction you have for us on that, because we do have capacity concerns. But it's complex. But yeah, I mean, I think that example that I gave is really kind of my best attempt at making a good example of what we do deal with that I think will qualify for an excess. And it really comes down to a facility has a level of expectation. They're relying on public funds and, you know, the services that we provide here. I don't want to use the term taking advantage of, but it happens. That's what I think we're talking about here.
Thank you. Jay, you had a couple things?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Erickson, members of the council. Just a few things to add for the benefit of the conversation. This conversation is just one piece among many efforts that we're trying to do to address the kind of spectrum of concern relative to kindergarten care within Brooklyn Park. We have a pretty significant legislative effort going on in collaboration with 9 other cities in the Northwest Metro, where we're trying to make some legislative changes, both in terms of, on a number of fronts, in terms of trying to get the inspections back that we once had, because we used to inspect all these properties through licensing that we no longer have, that was stripped away from all cities 2 to 3 years ago. We're also taking steps. Cities of the first class have these distancing requirements for some types of the kind of care facilities, and that's why you see in the map that Chief Conway showed that Minneapolis and St. Paul does not have the concentration that a lot of the suburbs in the Northwest Metro have, partly because of those distancing requirements. So we're trying to get those in place here within, actually in every city across the state. And then some of these concerns with regard to care, sometimes there are patients or residents that the current care facility is realizing that they're not best suited to provide care because of the needs of these patients. We've run into that a number of times in trying to ease the administrative burden of transferring those residents or patients from one kind of care facility to a more appropriate facility. Currently, it's a very challenging, burdensome process, and we recognize for the benefit of the resident and for the benefit of the staff that there are some hiccups, or not hiccups, but there are some challenges with that. And so there are 4 or 5 areas where we are working legislatively very aggressively on that. So I just want to highlight that for the benefit of the public that's in the room, any of the public that might listen to this conversation, and also for the benefit of the council. And so this was, in terms of this consideration for attaching fees to excessive or inappropriate use, this was one avenue that we wanted to have a conversation with the council on. As has been highlighted this evening, it's a little bit more clear-cut for the lithosis for the fire departments of applying this type of fee structure. It gets a little bit more challenging, as Chief Faust is highlighting, for the police department in terms of kind of the unintended consequences of implementing a fee structure like this to some of the services that the police department provides. It's a little harder. Could be administratively burdensome as well, both in terms of just merely invoicing, but also the work that an officer would have to be involved in terms of looking into the matter before identifying it as something either inappropriate or excessive. That said, we do want to fully explore to the depth that the council wants us to with regard to fire and police services. At the same time, as suggested by Councilmember Schelling and others, not deterring those 911 calls, because if people are in need within the community, we want them to feel free to call 911 and for our police and fire services to respond, because we know that we've got great staff, do a great job. As was highlighted by, last thing I'll say is, was highlighted by Deputy Chief Fowles, we're really looking for council's direction on, do you want us to continue to explore this and bring back a more refined recommendation? And is there any particular pieces of what's been highlighted this evening that you want us to take off the table, or any pieces that you want us to really zero in on? I think that would be the best guidance here as we work to bring it to a close. Thank you.
I'll start out saying I'm interested in seeing a more formal ordinance and fee schedule brought before council. I don't know if my colleagues concur.
Could you repeat that?
I would be open to seeing a formal ordinance change and fee schedule brought before council. And I also had a sort of random thought during Jay's suggestion. Could a city have kind of a rights and responsibilities document for congregate care employees? Like, if your employer is asking you to do something unethical, you can report that to police department, fire department, whatever. Like, if, I mean, I can imagine an operator telling an employee, okay, I don't want to get another $1,000 charge, so don't call 911. And we don't want to put low-wage, stressed-out workers in that position. So is there some kind of protection we could offer to employees of these organizations?
I'd like to add to that as well. Even back to the question that I had brought up in terms of deterring folks from calling, I mean, can't that alone be seen as documentation towards like that criminal offense if they were to not call 911 during an emergency because they don't want to pay the fines, right? Is there any sort of documentation that we could then take to utilize?
I'd have to check into that. I need to check into that further to see what boundaries the city has versus the state licensing and what who has jurisdiction over what. But I would say this, that the direction that staff is heading is not to tell employees not to have their staff call 911, but say, don't call 911 for list assist, okay, that offer a problem patient, I'm going to increase the probability of having a decline on this. And so I think that's what you're looking for, not you know, it's just not a meat axe approach. it's a scalpel to focus on a number of problems. And so I do think you could, we could look at the whether or not you could come up with a broader regulation or advice that goes further than what you're trying to accomplish.
Yeah, I personally am for it. I mean, I think it's very much sets the boundaries, right? And also sets a lot of accountability aspects for all sides as well. The inappropriate use, the excessive use, I think it all makes sense to me. I unfortunately, like, you know, I'm not in your guys' field, and so I very much trust that, you know, probably already worked out so many different scenarios and it ultimately came down to this one. And so I would like to see that ordinance written in paper and what it would look like. Out of curiosity as well, based upon that 15% of fire calls, what percentage of that was actually like legitimate emergency from 2025, the 15% out of all the calls, and including for police as well, 10% of the calls, what percentage of that was considered emergency from those congregate care facilities?
Chair Erickson, members of the council, Councilmember Jean. The classification, and I can provide more details on what that looks like, but you could consider the remaining percentages immediate emergency response between emergency medical services, fire, or specialized in rescue. So of those 9,000 calls, we're responding to emergencies. It's tough, and I can give you some information so you can kind of see what that looks like. But when somebody calls 911, they say they're short of breath. Okay, that goes to the dispatch center. It's dispatched to us. They're short of breath. That's what's considered to be a chief complaint. That chief complaint follows through the treatment, even if it was anxiety. So what some people consider an emergency compared to what medical providers consider emergency sometimes differ. So we look at anything above a low acuity call to be an emergency response, even if it's providing some education. Hot water heaters sometimes break. Their basement fills with smoke, even though it's steam. They're calling 911 because they're nervous, they're afraid. We're going to respond and fix their problem for them. That's just what we do. We can break down some of those nuances, but those 15.8% of the 9,000 calls, those are low acuity calls. But what I will do is we'll go back, just as we've been discussing this evening. The data mining and some of these metrics is difficult, and we are getting better because this is on our radar. So over the last 5 years, as these calls continue to increase, we are getting better about pulling some of those metrics out of those call responses. And we've gone to house fires at group homes, we've gone to cardiac arrest at group homes. I mean, Chief Burley gave us that example of that cardiac arrest at a group home. The individual who called 911 and who performed CPR was not even an employee. The employee of the group home paid his friend to just fill in for him. And so there's a lot of different nuances that we are getting better at data mining.
Councilmember Tran. Councilmember Tran, you're on mute.
I believe that if people, the staff, they call 911 just because they can do their job, that is very wrong. Because, you know, if you are in this career, you know, you should know how to deal with the patient, the people that you take care. And that is the problem with the, you know, managing or maintenance. That should not call 911. This is the abuse of the service.
Councilmember Page.
Okay. So I would be interested in more detail in the ordinance to... I've been trying to keep all these notes, so I apologize. To define what those lictus is or what it is, right, for excessive. Did you mention how many of the group homes are excessive calls? Like, is there a number or a percentage for reference?
Chair Dirksen, members of the council, member Page. I don't, the police department doesn't have hard numbers on what, we've never really collected and designated as this type of call success. We've never really collected that specific data. We have a 50% return rate to facilities. That's just based on a presentation we got last week. It's basically the facilities in which we have multiple calls to, the ones that we do, we get a lot of return calls to. There's a few facilities that we get very few calls to, and those aren't really the ones that we're worried about, but there's a select few that we get repeat over and over and over and over calls. response to it. And those are the ones that we have limited tools. And I think that's kind of what we're really focusing in on here. We haven't really, the police department hasn't really collected the data, really haven't even thought about this in terms of excessive use until recently. So, and then I guess, not to get too into the nuances of it, but we're still kind of discussing what even the definition of excessive is, because it's not, it's a difficult thing to define. And that's when I get back to the really each one of these needs to, I think, be looked at in a case-by-case basis. And really the totality of the circumstances has to be looked at. And I just also want to highlight something that Councilmember Jean said, and she used the word accountability. I think that's really what our goal here is we want the facilities to be more accountable for what happens inside and what their staff members do. And this is an idea on how to increase accountability, because when there's no consequences for not being accountable, and the state does do inspections, they do investigations, we do mark reports dozens per day, very rarely do we get a mark report back where they substantiate an investigation. If they do, it's 6 to 8 months, unless it's really severe where we have to really escalate it. But a typical mark report, we're not hearing anything back for a long period of time, and that's just the volume of it. But accountability is really, I think, what the goal that we're trying to achieve here, and this is one idea, and I do think that it could potentially achieve that. It might have other consequences as well, like we've highlighted. But we have not collected data on excessive use, but there's plenty of cases out there, I can guarantee you that. And they make up the bulk of the top facilities that we get called to would be the ones that are just the repeat.
Okay, just to finalize my comments on that, I think it's just such a bigger issue with the amount of facilities, which I've already said that, but there's a lot of time being spent on this, so I think there's also opportunity, big picture, to really not continue to push these problems down the road to the next. We started, it was high 300s, then it was high 400s. We heard from another report in the last month from someone that it was in the 500s. So it's a problem, and I think if there's any opportunity there just to add some reflection on what we can do to have accountability in our city where we have no accountability or limited accountability. I don't even know who's going to hire. So I don't know how we fix that. I don't have a suggestion for that, but I do think it's important for us to understand we've got a bigger problem here. So I don't know if that's helpful to the conversation. But so I'd be very interested to say, like, what the right now, and define what that excessive calls is, and then what particular calls that, you know, in language that we can understand.
Sure. And I just want to reiterate, I'd like that you pointed that out, accountability, Deputy Chief. Because we also need accountability from the state. They're the ones that have taken this whole thing over, and this is the result we have. But I wanted to ask, what is the name of that report? Is it actually Mark, M-A-R-K? What's the name of it?
M-A-A-R-C, I believe, is the acronym. And please don't ask me to tell you what the acronym is. I cannot remember. I'm sure you'd be. Mark reports are available to the public. We use the same system to report marks as does any resident does.
I mean, in the big picture, and I could go on for hours about this probably, but I want to find out what the state's requirements are to issue a license. I mean, are they based on the previous information I asked for? And I'm not asking this question now, but it's rhetorical, basically. Do those different names require a different set of skills? Do they require a different level of workers' comp insurance? Do they, you know, all those things that come with employment? And as I said last time we were discussing this, I promise you that at least half of these facility operators, not the operators, the quote-unquote employees, of these operators are not actually employees. They're probably independent contractors, or at least classified as such, and therefore are probably required to carry their own workers' comp insurance, which might maybe be $12 an hour, whatever the case may be, $25 an hour. I'm not going out and shopping for a workers' comp premium I can afford, especially if I have to lift, you know, heavy individuals on a regular basis. So they're riding on the bar workers' comp on our city employees. Anyway, like I said, I could go on and on, but appreciate all the information. I do want to look into this mark, and I want to look into what they require in order to issue a license. So, thank you.
So I think what I'm hearing is we want more. Come back to us with your specific ask. I mean, I think this council trusts your professional guidance and knowledge and experience. And I think ultimately, like with many things, your staff has some discretion. If police officer shows up at a place, they know whether it's negligence, laziness, legitimate frustration, someone's at their limit. Like, your people see enough every day to know what's what. And so I think we all trust you to know what will help our city cover some of these costs. So, anything further? Thank you all.
We get to keep these fancy red folders.
Now you have to give them back.
These are very special to Sean.
They are.
Snacks.
That is one of those drafts.
Oh, yeah.
So in your packet, I didn't put that in your packets. You'll find definitions. That wasn't part of the presentation. It's just some additional information for you to help.
Okay, that's something I didn't see that in there.
That's okay.
Gotcha.
That's good. That's what we're going to discuss. Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you all.
Right. Our next item is a conversation on economic recovery plan related to immigration enforcement. It's 10.2. It looks like the Community Development Department is on deck here.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Acting Chair, members of the City Council. Much like the last case, we're not adopting any policy or program here today. We will do a deeper dive. Actually, next week we've got some of these program criteria, but we wanted to talk about the higher level strategy a little bit first before we took official program policy to you next week. And so this will likely require, next week is our EDA meeting, which we're going to be meeting on Tuesday. We will probably schedule a special meeting of the City Council to start that. One of these is not a financial program, it's actually an ordinance change regarding eviction protection, not eviction moratorium, but that takes two reading and some publication, so we want to advance that a little bit quicker. So tonight, we are actually talking about three strategies that fit within two buckets. Within the bucket of financial assistance, we'll talk about some emergency business assistance, the first step in relation to the economic impacts of some of the immigration enforcement has had an impact on our local economy, our local businesses. So first, we want to work on improving economic conditions. The second being rental assistance. We know there's going to be some degree of impact on residents being able to pay for their monthly rent. And then the second bucket, third strategy, is eviction protection, which we'll get into in a little bit here. As you think about this, this has become compared to a lot of the impacts and response we had during the COVID pandemic. The one thing I will say with these programs, we're going to have to be a lot more precise. This is very much impactful to a subset of our community, and also we don't have federal dollars coming towards us in this case. So I think we need to admit that our role is probably to bridge a gap until more resources come. The amount of need out there far outpaces the resources we have available today. So we're going to have to be pretty precise of how we deploy that, and that's coming from this group in previous work sessions as well. So it's going to be focused. There's going to be very limited qualifying criteria. We have to be able to show financial history to show that there was a recent impact. This is a strategy we did during the COVID pandemic. And then probably the biggest barrier we're going to have is we're going to have to prove some relationship or nexus to immigration enforcement. And so that requires asking some questions that might be difficult, or maybe perhaps those that need the resources are going to be a little hesitant to give that information to us. And this is going to be a moving target. So before I go on to the next slide, I'll also say that this doesn't end tonight. You know, what we're doing right now is focusing on the area of greatest need. We can always add to this as time goes on. So what a lot of other communities are doing right now is allocating dollars, keeping it pretty focused, and then peeling back and adding to those resources as we can better define that need. So we're really filling the gap. The resources are changing daily. Our staff has been having numerous conversations with peer communities, with peer organizations. It seems every day there's another philanthropic opportunity out there, so we're going to try to leverage those as best as possible. It's going to require some tweaking and coming back to the council, the EDA, on a regular basis. Just today, we got word of another program that we can leverage as well that is very similar to some of the things that we are trying to do. So I do have a number of colleagues up here that are going to spend time. Each has a slide that they're going to do the high-level overview of the proposed program, stand for questions. So we're going to do one slide at a time per topic. We can discuss that, ask questions, and we'll move on to the next. So to kick things off, I'm going to have Solia Tucker, our newer, not so much new anymore, but business development coordinator, talk about the business assistance program. So I'll just got the one slide here that Solia can talk about.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Tim. And in response to what we're seeing right now and the overwhelming need, as was stated from our initial outreach for businesses, they've referenced financial need as the most urgent matter at hand. And with that in mind, we have proposed a city response of establishing a BP Spark Fund that entails $270,000 of total funding to be allocated, ranging from $2,500 to roughly $25,000, depending on the tiers and the needs that we're seeing. We do have a structure as far as the levels of tiers, stabilization, that being with our smaller to mid-sized businesses that are in the city here, and of course, stabilization and recovery being predominantly what we're envisioning these funding going towards, with the broader view of the resilience tier in the future of upcoming needs based on our continuing efforts around this.
So Mr. Chair, this is where we'll pause. Let's focus a little bit on the business assistance. See what questions you have, if you're comfortable with that allocation. So at this point, we'll stand for questions on this sub-part of the presentation. Mr. Chair, by the way, this would come out of one of our EDA fund balances, so we would have cash on hand to do that. It's like I anticipated a question. Sorry.
That is exactly what I was going to say, is where it's coming from, so thank you for that. And then what does that mean for the technical assistance programs? What does that mean?
Thank you for the question, Councilmember Page. That entails a partnership with our small business center to sort of provide that long-term stabilization effort with cohort programming at the center there. We have a few partners that do business cohorts, and The vision is to have a funding allocated set aside to provide that more of a subsidizing those programming so that we can have, based on the funding or interest there, to allow for those small businesses to be a part of that program at the center.
You'll have to maybe dumb it down a little bit for me. So what is the technical assistance? What is the program?
Yeah, so we have a couple at the Small Business Center with CAPI Small Business Cohort Programming, and oftentimes we do partner there with a couple of our partners at the center. Roughly, I believe there are a number of programming from NDC to CAPI and a few others that do provide those more hands-on technical services, so business planning, business plan, marketing plan. So our vision is to allocate that $10,000 for us to provide that extra space where our businesses in need of those services can be a part of that program, cohort programming at the center.
So are we paying them to come in and do that programming, or have they volunteered that already, or is that what we're working on now?
Oh, no, thank you for the question. For clarification, we are not paying the cohort. We are just, if there are any service fees or funding or application fees, that is to have a reserved funding amount to subsidize or allow businesses if there's a need for it.
Okay, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
You mentioned having to prove an impact related to immigration enforcement. Does that cover all three of the programs we're talking about here? So,
Chair, yes.
Okay. So, for example, if a business has had to close down for a couple days because one of their key employees was detained, that would be proof of a impact or a enforcement consequence, right?
Correct. That is one of our factors, determining factors. And also the longevity of how long they're closed, how many employees were impacted, as well as looking at those financial records to kind of leverage how what that impact looks like. So the holistic approach to answer your question is yes, it'll be included.
So we may be able to continue doing that kind of checking without actually asking anyone their immigration status.
Correct.
Sorry, I wasn't sure. It was being
corrected. Thank you. Correct.
Chair, not seeing any questions, but pause and make sure we don't skip over that.
Topic two.
The next piece would be from John Canara, our Housing and Redevelopment Coordinator, talking a little bit about rental assistance programs. So, John, if you want to take it away.
Okay, thanks, Tim. Chair Erickson, Council members, my name is John Canara, and here to talk about the proposed rental assistance program. This is a very narrow, tailored rental assistance program to residents within our community who have been impacted by the immigration enforcement efforts. We do know a few residents have not been going to work because they're afraid of getting outside of their homes and therefore they're not getting any income. We also know some residents who work at some establishments that are closed, and therefore they have no place to go to work. And so we have conversations with our peer cities. They're considering similar assistance programs. This week, the city of Minneapolis approved about $1 million to go towards rental assistance for residents that live within the city of Minneapolis. You know, St. Louis Park is having discussions about the similar thing, and so we are not playing catch up, but we want to be proactive so that we know evictions are going to come up, because we have received a few calls from residents who are concerned about what rent they are going to pay, how they're going to pay. So we're proposing to spend about $300,000 that will come out of the local affordable housing aid, which is currently within the local housing trust fund that was established in 2024, and proposing to award about $1,000 to those impacted residents to pay towards their rent, which is about the average median rent for a one bedroom within Brooklyn Park. And then we're going to target at those residents with incomes at below 60% of the area median income. And we want to repeat the similar process we used in 2021 during COVID time, whereby we worked with the property managers to identify the residents who are late on rent, verify the status, and sign a very simple form, verify that they have been impacted, and then we can send the amount to the property manager to apply to those ledgers that are late. And so, alternatively, if council members, you propose sending the money directly to the residents, you can do that as well. So we're just here to provide information and get feedback on how to proceed. And I will stop there and take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Pinaro. Why have we established it below 60% AMI? Because people may be suffering across the board here, regardless of their, I mean, probably not wealthy people, but all levels of the working class, I would assume, are going to be suffering.
Chair Erickson and Councilmember Mugabe, that's a very good question. The source of funding we're going to use, the local affordable housing aid, requires for rental assistance for individuals that make less than 80% of the area median income. So we could go higher, but we can't go beyond 80%. We thought 60% AMI, that would be the area where most people are impacted, especially residents in Brooklyn Park in the rental community. Majority of them, that's where they fall in terms of the income they make within a given period of time. Yeah.
Thank you. So is that a fixed number, 60% of the AMI? I mean, I know it probably fluctuates with time, but I don't know, is that something that you would make if you have to have like a job at Wendy's and a job at Napa Auto Parts and a job at the gas station?
Councilor,
is that
yeah.
getting paid $12 an hour to run a cash register at Walmart?
Councilmember McGavin, it's a fixed number that's issued annually by the Department of Housing based on the area's median incomes. So depending on where you work, how much you're paid, so those numbers, they come out annually and they show the thresholds of incomes made for each individual within a given location.
So can you tell me what that number is right now for Brooklyn Park?
I don't even on top of my head, but I can look it up, yeah.
And Mr. Chair, we can forward, you know, HUD or my council pull some these numbers.
Yeah.
What is that area median income? How does that correlate to average rent by number of bedrooms? How does that correlate to, you know, average price home? So all of that is prescribed out every all the time. And actually, the 60% AMI is a pretty important threshold, pretty common threshold for housing assistance. I get back to, we only have so many resources, we're going to have to be pretty precise of how we deploy that and really focus those in the most need that are often left out in the process. So that led to some of our decision-making, bringing that to 60% AMI, which is pretty in line with other housing assistance programs.
Thank you. Yeah, if I could just have the resource, sorry, Chair. I can look that up myself, that number. I don't need it right now.
We will forward that to you after the meeting.
Yeah,
it's pretty easy to find on the Met Council website.
Pardon me?
It's pretty easy to find on the Met Council website. It's a pretty elaborate chart.
Tell me.
It's 114 for 80.
If you were to Google, Mr. Chair, affordability thresholds, Metropolitan Council, it's going to give you all of that information.
Okay.
Yeah, actually, it's right here. It's for 2025, 60% AMI is $79,440.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's for family of four.
Yeah.
Yeah, family of four, yeah.
Customer page?
I think I might have missed it, but I'm not sure. Just asking for clarity. I mean, prior to me stepping out of the room, Dr. Glanville, you mentioned how we're going to have to be very, very specific, right? And ensuring that this money is going towards families in need. It's not like how it was during the pandemic, right? So I don't know if I missed it, but with this rental assistance, have we figured out a way in terms of how to narrow it down specifically to families being affected by the immigration landscape? Is there a way to identify that?
Yeah, Councilmember Chong. Yes, we've identified that. My director team said we're going to have to verify. You have to provide documentation to verify that you've been impacted by these federal actions. And for example, somebody who's no longer working, they could get a letter from their former employer that they're not working there anymore. Or a specific reason. There has to be a correlation between why you have a balance on your ledger and the actions that are taking place, how they have impacted you. So we'll need that as part of the supporting document to be eligible to qualify for this award. And we're going to work with property managers for these properties to provide those supporting documents.
And Mr. Chair, just repeat a question or comment you had as well. I don't know if you were in the room, council member, but there are questions we can ask that don't specifically ask, you know, the citizenship status question. So like Mr. Kanara mentioned, we're looking for loss of income, we're looking for job loss, we're looking for something to make that correlation. And so we've got some more work to do in the next week. It's not perfect yet, and that's why we'll just continue to start as precise as we can and loosen up as we grow and learn a little bit.
So are you asking us about our opinion on the payments directly to the...
All right. These are just so funny. These are different than the other ones. Are you asking us then what our preference is for, or our opinions, and have discussion on if it's direct to the property owner or the... Okay.
Yeah, Chair Erickson, Councilmember Page. Yes, that's one of the questions, options for you to consider. Staff is recommending working directly with property managers because we've done that before and it was an efficient process. But we are open to any ideas that you may propose as well.
Thank you. So I would add that I agree with that. I think that's a great way to do that. And your departments have the resources for these programs? You've figured out who's going to do another job?
Mr. Chair, Council, we're lacking capacity to really do a good job at this. So I think it's going to be a combination of a few things. Partnering with other agencies, whether that's Hennepin County or some of the items on the list here, those are some of the things that we need to work out. Whether it was during the COVID pandemic or others, or our programs that exist today, some of this is going to have a third party, and they'll take, their 5% admin fee, 5% of whatever the award is, and we'll try to minimize that. Where there is capacity to do that, we'll work through that. I don't know that there's going to be one size fits all. My guess is that at the end of the day, we'll have an allocation. We'll split that up in a few different ways, whether it's working with Hennepin County, one of our nonprofits that is leveraging other philanthropic dollars, and some city staff working directly with tenants or property managers. So not one solution, but I am concerned about capacity to do the right underwriting and oversight to make sure that those dollars are going to where they need to go. But we will figure out that resource.
Thank you, Chair. So that being said, just for a process, does this have to be multiple readings, or how does this work? When we put this in a, when we define our program and et cetera, how long is that? What's the process for that?
It's a pretty simple process, actually. Just give the direction to staff, make it self-implemented. There's no, we don't need to adopt ordinances or just direction to staff is really important.
A touch of question on the partnership opportunities aspect of it. If we are to partner with organizations on this, then would we have to also look to allocating a separate fund for their staff?
Mr. Chair, Council Member, what we're finding is there is quite the patchwork of how these other dollars are being applied. Some, you know, for example, we had met with LEDC, the Latino Economic Development Center. We asked that question, and they would not be charging a fee. You know, they're leveraging some dollars from the Minneapolis Foundation. They have their own dollars. They would love to partner with us on the Mekinet Matching Fund. And they said, we're just concerned about getting the dollars to where they would need to go, and they would not charge an additional admin fee. I don't know if it's going to be true for every agency. Hennepin County might charge. We're actually doing weekly calls with Hennepin County now with a few area community development directors. So, it's going to be a patchwork. Some are going to charge a fee, some are not. I think we're focused more on the overall allocation. Next week, we'll probably ask for a little bit of discretion on the executive director's point, my role, in that we can use that overall allocation and assign it in a variety of different ways to different organizations. We would want some sort of agreement, contract, MOU to make sure that if we're giving dollars to another organization, they have to follow those public expenditure rules and reporting and audit. So. And Mr. Chair, this is not an exhaustive list. And so if there are other partner agencies out there that want to consider partnering, we're willing to sit down and talk.
Okay, so it looks like we're ready to move on to number three.
Great. Thank you, Chair Erickson and members of the Council. Kara Donovan, Senior Planner for the record. So, like Don mentioned, we've already had folks that have reached out to the city with concern of eviction. This proposal is an expansion of an existing state statute. So, effective January 1st, 2024, statute started requiring landlords to issue a 14-day written notice before filing an eviction for non-payment of rent. So, directly applicable to the situation where folks are having an issue paying rent due to lack of employment right now. So the proposal is essentially just to extend that 14-day notice period to a 30-day period. This is being done by other peer cities, so this is in Minneapolis, Brooklyn Center, and St. Louis Park right now. And then there is an option to expand to businesses. I haven't seen something similar to this, but more than happy to explore that idea, and I think that Sally could answer some questions about that as well, depending on what council directs. Pretty simple, so with that, let's take your questions.
And this is the one we mentioned, that since it's an ordinance amendment, that it would have to have first reading and a special meeting next week, and then second reading the following council meeting. So it's a 2-week lead time on making this happen.
Yes, this one doesn't work out. We're moving it as fast as we can.
And Mr. Chair, it certainly could come back to questions. And so, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and we've heard requests to us directly as well, we heard it tonight, just calls for an eviction moratorium. And we've discussed this as a council level as well. We feel, and peer communities feel, that we just lack the authority at a local city level to enact our own eviction moratorium, which is why we're focused on whatever protections we are allowed to do under state statute. So really the state legislature or the governor through executive order, peacetime emergency declaration would have to do that. And we know this to be true. That, so if Minneapolis and St. Paul knew they had the authority to do this, they probably would have done this already. But they're not trying to do their own local ordinance on this. They're asking the state to step up and do that. So I'm sure that question will pop up at the session coming up in a couple weeks. I do think that lessons learned from the eviction moratorium during the COVID pandemic, that if that were to come forward, we don't think it's super likely, but if it were to come forward, there's probably some rooms for exceptions to that if it's true immediate public safety. If we do see that getting committee hearings, we might want to, on behalf of the PD, talk about what those exceptions would be.
our focus has really been in the last two examples of, number one, improving economic outcomes. That's always been our priority over housing assistance. And then as a safety net, we have the rental assistance that goes along too. So this provides a little bit more safety net on top of those two items as well. So just wanted to touch on the eviction moratorium because it has come up on several occasions at this dais as well. But I can, we can respond to any questions on this ordinance, but it is fairly straightforward, fairly common. There are other eviction protections that some of our partner organizations have suggested during anti-displacement or others. We can come back to those, but again, this has been emergency deployment, move quicker, focus on the top priorities, and then continue to add over time if we need to.
This is kind of a question about the three together plus others. So we've stood up this, the immigration emergency coordination team or
task force.
Is that team available, or are there any staff resources available to help residents navigate, like sort of stacking what might be available in the community?
Thank you, Chair Erickson. And to that question, as a, for the record, I'm a member of that committee, and those are all of our continuing discussions. Not a definitive answer at the moment, but certainly can take that back to the rest of the task force, and those are all of the options that we're exploring as far as capacity and where resources can be allocated as far as staff time.
And I would just add two pieces of that. And within our community development, we've been trying to embrace more the mentality of, some sort of tour guide or business navigator. So we've had a lot of staff, whether it's business resources, what Consolia does, for housing issue, Mr. Canara, and just a whole host of other staff that back those primary contacts up. And then we've shown a good history of just pivoting. So we've pivoted a lot of staff on multiple occasions doing business sweeps. We've retooled our door knocks for tenant support, and so we're not afraid to pivot those resources to prioritize as needed as well. So that'll be a culture that continues to thrive throughout this duration.
So the guidance you're looking for is, are we generally in favor of the first two? And then, are we ready for an ordinance next week for number three?
Yeah, and Mr. Chair, I would say if you're comfortable with all three are going to show up in some capacity next week. So we just want to make sure you're comfortable with that as it shows up on official agendas, as official policies and programs.
Just one question on the ordinance. The meeting, next week. I'm not sure what, we have to check the timing on the ordinance. Is that actually a city council action item?
Correct.
Not an ED action item, right?
It'd be a special, council meeting.
Yeah, okay.
And unless I'm reading the room wrong, I think council's amenable to all three of these at this point. So please do bring them back to us next week.
All right. Thank you.
Okay, thank you everybody. That was our last agenda item. That was our last agenda item, so the meeting is adjourned. I just adjourned. You can go home too.